She sold 3 fish for more money in one Saturday than she'd made from an entire season of tilapia. Not by weight, by name. They weren't food fish. They weren't headed for a pan or a fryer. They were scooped gently into clear bags, floated in coolers with battery-powered airstones, and driven away to backyard ponds with waterfalls and landscaped rock edges. The price tag on each one was written on a tiny piece of painter's tape stuck to the side of a 5-gallon bucket. $80, $120, $220. The buyers barely blinked. The fish you're not supposed to eat live in a different universe. And if you treat them like food fish, they will break your heart and your wallet in the same season. Last time we talked about the end of the cycle, about that moment 5 months in when your bucket is finally full, when you have to decide whether you're harvesting on time or squeezing your tank for just a little more and paying for it in flavor and stress. Tilapia and that first full bucket are the foundation of a backyard aquaculture operation built on food. Today we step sideways into something else entirely. Ornamental fish. Koi, goldfish, fancy carp. The animals people buy not to eat, but to look at, to name, to watch. The stakes are different here. The biology overlaps. But the economics and the psychology are another world. Here is the first thing you need to understand about koi. They are not expensive goldfish. They are living art objects whose value is tied less to their weight and more to their pattern, color, and condition. A supermarket tilapia is sold by the pound. A koi is sold by the fish, sometimes by the inch. Sometimes, in the high-end world, as a one-off with a name, like a painting. That means one fish with the right pattern and clean, undamaged fins can be worth what an entire tank of food fish brings in. It also means that one mistake in care, one preventable water quality slip, one overcrowded month, one unnoticed nip in the tail can erase that value completely. The woman who sold those 3 koi for $80, $120, and $220 had not meant to become a koi seller. She started with tilapia, like most people in this series, because she wanted protein and a side income. The koi came later, when a local landscaper asked if she'd ever thought about using her spare IBC tote as a holding tank for ornamental fish. "They're not for eating," he said, "but people will pay for them like they are." That line lodged in her brain and sat there while she watched videos and read forums at night, learning words like Kohaku and Sanke and Showa, learning that the world of koi has its own language, its own standards, its own quiet, obsessive community. From a care perspective, koi are hardy. They can handle a broad range of temperatures, from near freezing to the upper 80s, as long as the change is gradual. They tolerate a wider pH range than many food fish. They eat a varied diet, pellets, vegetables, even fruit. They are curious, social, and in a backyard pond, they become visible characters in the landscape. All of that makes them attractive to a homesteader brain that has already learned how to manage water quality for food, fish. "I'm already testing ammonia and pH," you think. How hard could this be? Harder than it looks. For one reason. Appearance is not just a bonus here. It is the product. A tilapia with a slightly torn fin will still sell as food. A tilapia with a scar or a patch of rough scale will still fillet clean and fry up fine. A koi with a torn fin is instantly devalued. A koi whose white scales take on a faint yellowish cast from tannins in the water, or whose deep red pattern high fades because of stress, is not just stressed. It is worth less money. Overcrowding is not merely a water quality issue. It is a cosmetic issue. A fish that spends months bumping other fish in tank walls in tight quarters will wear its environment in its fins and scales. Here is where the garden ghost for this episode lives. It doesn't look like disease. It doesn't look like a fish gasping at the surface or lying on the bottom. It looks like a tiny fray at the very tip of a koi's tail. It looks like the faintest white fuzz on the edge of a pectoral fin, or a single scale out of line on an otherwise immaculate body. You stand at the edge of the tank, watching them glide and turn, and you see one fish whose edges just don't look as clean as the others. You tell yourself you're imagining it. You tell yourself it's just the light. You will see that same fish again weeks later when you go to bag it for a buyer, and by then, what was a tiny whisper of overcrowding or low-grade stress has turned into a visible flaw that drops the price in half. Let's talk about how koi fit into a backyard operation in practical terms. You can raise them in the same physical spaces you raise food, fish, stock tanks, IBC totes, line ponds, but the design priorities flip. For tilapia, your primary metrics are growth rate, feed conversion, and survival. For koi, your primary metrics are pattern quality, body shape, and condition. You're not pushing for maximum biomass per gallon. You're curating individuals. A basic starter koi setup might be a single 300 to 500 gallon tank with a strong biofilter, an air pump, and a simple overhead cover to control light and protect against predators. Instead of stocking 50 or 60 fish, you might stock 20. Instead of planning to harvest them all at the same size, you might plan to sell some at 6 inches, some at 10, and keep a few longer to see who turns into something special. That something special is easier to spot when they are small than most people think, once you know what to look for. Even in a batch of plain domestic koi, there will be one fingerling whose white is bone clean instead of dull, whose red is deep and even, whose pattern wraps the body in a way that looks balanced from above. The first time you scoop one of those out of the tank and hold it in a white bucket, a plain little fish, 6 or 8 weeks old, barely longer than your finger, you may not fully believe yet that it could be worth $100 by fall, but the potential is there. That plain-looking koi fingerling in a bucket is the recurring image of this episode for a reason. What you do with the months between that moment and sale day will decide whether that potential pays out or evaporates. Water quality for koi is, in many ways, the same story you've already learned. Ammonia and nitrite at zero. Nitrates kept low with water changes. Stable pH in the neutral to slightly alkaline range. Strong oxygenation. But the threshold for good enough is different.
A tilapia can shrug off a 3-day flirtation with slightly elevated nitrates and show no visible effect. A koi living in that same water may keep its health but lose a little of its edge, color fading just a bit, skin luster dulling. The fish survives, the price softens. Think about your filtration and stocking like this. With koi, you are always underutilizing your biological capacity on purpose. You could stock more. You choose not to because you're not selling pounds. You're selling perfection. When things go wrong with koi, they often go wrong quietly first.
The first sign in an overcrowded or underfiltered koi tank is not usually a dead fish. It's a change in movement. You'll see more flashing, quick, sharp sideways turns as fish rub themselves briefly against the tank wall or bottom. You'll see the edges of fins look just the tiniest bit ragged when the light hits at the right angle. You may notice that a fish whose white used to look crisp now reads a touch beige when you compare it against the color of the bucket during a routine inspection. Those are your early warning signals. That is the water and the environment telling you that what was fine for survival is no longer fine for value. The woman who sold those 3 koi for the first time did not start with perfect conditions. Her initial koi tank was, by her own description, a little too busy. Too many fish. Not enough hiding places. The pump was strong, but the biomedia basket was undersized. The fish lived, grew, and ate, but by midsummer she was seeing a pattern. Every time she thought about taking a few to a landscaper friend who had offered to connect her to buyers, she'd net them out, drop them into a white inspection tub, and see something she hadn't noticed from above. A nicked fin. A patch of scales that didn't lie as flat as they should. A slight haze over the eyes of one otherwise beautiful fish. She culled hard that first year, selling only the most perfect fish at lower beginner prices and keeping the rest. She learned to see the garden ghost earlier. When she saw the very first hint of tail-tip fray on a promising fish, she didn't shrug it off. She thinned the tank. She upgraded the biofilter. She added more structure, a few pieces of smooth PVC and rock to break line of sight and reduce constant bumping. She shaded the tank more carefully, keeping direct midday sun off the water to protect color. By the second season, she stocked fewer koi and watched them more closely. That same plain bucket held fish that were no longer just pretty pond fillers. They were individually evaluated inventory. She kept a simple notebook where she sketched patterns from above, 3 islands of red on white, 1 shoulder patch, a clean head, and tracked which fish she wanted to hold and which she was ready to move. When a landscaper called needing a dozen koi for a client's new pond, she had a short list ready. Those 12 fish, sold individually by size and pattern, paid for her entire year's feed and equipment. If food fish are about resilience and volume, koi are about attention and timing. The basic biology is not harder. The margin for aesthetic error is smaller.
You cannot treat a $200 fish like a $4 fish and expect the math to work. You don't need to become a Japanese koi judge to make ornamental fish part of your backyard income. You do need to respect that good enough water for tilapia is almost there for koi. You need to learn to see that tiny whisper of fin fray not as something you can fix later, but as your tank telling you right now that you are pushing your luck and pushing your profit margin. That plain little koi in the bucket, the one that doesn't look particularly special to anyone else yet, is your leverage. In 6 months, handled carefully, it can help pay for your system upgrades, your winter heating bill, the new pump that means you never lose oxygen overnight. Or, handled carelessly, it can become just another pretty fish you end up giving away because the high-end buyer takes one look at the tail and says, "No, thank you." So here is the question I want you to sit with before we move on to the money side of this in the next episode. If you add koi into your backyard operation, are you going to treat them like artwork you steward and release only when they're truly ready, or like inventory you're willing to discount the moment the first little flaw shows up?